you know, to make the best case you can for Donald Trump, he said that he was not a politician, that he's there to drain the swamp, that he wants to break the habits of Washington. And, of course, Washington's going to cling to its habits and try to damage him. I think there's a case to be made that of course, he's going to run into the kind of difficulties that he's run into.
But the point you're making, which I agree with,
is that we are at a heightened moment of national consciousness about what a republic means and what a constitutional
system
means.
And studying Jefferson and looking at what happened to the nation and to him during his time is such a broadening of it. It's a way to sort of ameliorate the conditions that we're living in now, to have that sort of long view and broad perspective. For me, it is.
For me, too. And, you know, when you hear Jefferson saying, and I really made the point of this today, that he was not a man who wanted power. First of all, you we're so cynical. We just think it can't be true. It can't be true. But what if it is true? And when you think, what if it were true that somebody of great capacity who was beyond the lust for power agreed to help us through the birth pangs of the 21st century?
Uh-huh.
It just makes you kind of ache, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But again, part of me, even though I'm making the case for Jefferson, thinks, oh, well, maybe he really was more engaged than we think. But whatever is the case, Jefferson retired, thought he was retiring permanently in December of 1793, has a couple of years where he sort of becomes a melancholic because he's at Monticello and he doesn't have enough engagement in the world. And then Madison, the great Madison, draws him back in, and Jefferson goes to Washington to become the vice president in the Adams administration. And in a certain sense, the rest will follow from that, because once he's back in the arena, Jefferson is too good and too committed to his vision to stand by and watch other people damage it. And so once he's back in Philadelphia as the vice president to Adams, it's virtually inevitable that Jefferson is going to re-engage in a big way, and he does, and he becomes the third president, and I wouldn't say one of the greatest presidents in American history, but one of the most consequential in American history.
It was a great conversation. Just mention a couple of things. Your summer tour.
The Becky tour, 18th through 25th of 27th of July.
Beat that one into the ground.
No, he didn't. I love that trip. It's my most refreshing moment of the year.
Then rather than repeat ourselves, go to jeffersonhour.com, click on cultural tours. You can find out everything you want to know about
it. You can walk in the exact footprints of Lewis and Clark and canoe where they canoed and camp where they camped and climb the mountain that Lewis made them climb.
JeffersonHour.com, oddytours.net.
July 18th through 27th, oddytours.net, or my website, clayjenkinson.com, or jeffersonhour.com.
And speaking of heroes like Lewis and Clark that are no longer with us.
Yes.
Chuck Berry died.
Wait a minute. What's your segue to that?
He's a hero that is no longer
with us. I know,
but
really, Jefferson, Lewis, Berry.
Yeah.
What? Tell me just for a moment why Berry matters to you.
You know, I lived in Minneapolis. Do you really want to hear this?
Yes, I do.
We can fast forward.
No, our public wants to hear it too.
I lived in Minneapolis in the early 70s, you know, barely a kid.
When rock and roll was in its early adulthood.
Well, no, I think it was earlier. Anyway, I had a job downtown. Have I ever told you this? I worked at the Dayton's office in downtown.
No way. You worked for Dayton's?
I lived at 1818 LaSalle in this little carriage house.
It's like the Macy's of Minnesota.
Yeah, and I had a job on the fourth floor.
Of Macy's and on the Nicollet Mall.
Dayton's, and I sold tickets for every sporting event, concert, and play.
You were Ticketmaster.
Made like $84 a week.
You were Ticketmaster before Ticketmaster.
But I got comps to everything I wanted to see.
How did this even happen? You're a North Dakotan to the core.
So, you know, it was the Guthrie every weekend. Duke Ellington.
Why were you
Tom
in Minneapolis?
Waits.
Why were you in Minneapolis?
Well, that's where every good North Dakotan
goes briefly. Yes, all right.
So, but then it came up, Chuck Berry at the Minneapolis Auditorium.
How old would he have been then?
Oh, geez, I don't. Well, 70s, probably he was in his 50s. So,
wow. No. So,
yeah.
No, so, because he just died.
No, he was 90.
Oh, my.
Yeah. So I got these tickets, and my lovely not yet wife Jan and I went to see Chuck Berry.
Your two kids.
Minneapolis Auditorium had pretty good seats, you know, because it was general seating. We got up close and it was, you know, real old building and fold up rickety chairs.
That's where professional wrestling was, but that's another question.
Maybe Chrysler will enjoy this. I don't know.
Somebody
probably
has
lost
to.
Everybody. Yeah. I'll be brief. So at that time, Chuck Berry traveled by himself. He drove his Cadillac to the gig. He got there 5 minutes before he was supposed to go on. He walked in. He went to the promoter's office. He opened his briefcase for the $10,000 or $11,000 in cash. He got $11,000, and he gave $1,000 back if the gear was good and the band could keep up with
him. That was good of him.
He never carried a band with him at that point. They would hire local union musicians. And they would say, do you know Chuck Berry songs? And, of course, every musician does. So there he was on stage with these glam rockers.
What's a glam rocker?
Oh, it was guys, you know, early on, they were wearing leotards and you know, all that stuff.
Okay.
And it was all new. And, you know, they were way too cool to be playing old Chuck Berry songs.
They were not that sure they wanted to be doing
Well, they
Chuck
were
Berry.
Just way too cool to be playing old Chuck
okay.
Berry songs. So he comes out on stage and he starts and... As the evening progressed through the first three or four songs, he went to each player and got in their face and grinned. And one by one, you saw all of these really cool glam rockers just melt.
Come to life.
By the end of that show, I did something I had never done at a concert since or before.
I can't wait to hear this.
I stood on my chair.
No way.
I did.
You're not a chair-standing kind of guy.
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people are, oh, Chuck Berry, the old 50s. So, guy was a poet. You know, you and I ought to have a little discussion.
Well, name four songs of his.
Nadine is a great one.
Of course.
Oh, Baby Doll.
Okay.
I love that. Just an odd meter.
Two more.
Two more that I really like.
Yeah.
Probably You Can't Catch Me.
Okay.
And, you know, not, there's all those classics, but you got to say Roll Over Beethoven.
Is there an album one should listen to?
Oh, there. You know, if you're on Spotify, everything is available.
Okay. So, but his passing.
Yeah.
How that comes from Meriwether Lewis, I'm not quite certain, but his passing affected you, of course.
Well, Meriwether Lewis, you know, he died. And
as do we all. Yeah. But I take your point, a hero.
I'm sorry for that, podcast
No, it's
listeners.
Good. That's no, they, now they get to know you a little better.
Yeah, yeah.
There you are as a kid, working for Dayton's on the Nicollet Mall.
Oh, I saw so many great shows.
And you're going to the Guthrie.
Yeah, every week, and the Walker. And
the Walker Art Center, which at the time was one of the world's avant-garde art centers.
Oh, they had having somebody there teaching me about de Kooning and seeing the originals. It was great.
It was
terrific, yeah.
So what brought you back to Dakota?
Recording studios.
And that's a whole other
story.
epic story.
Yeah. So let's go to the show.
So Thomas Jefferson, coming out of retirement, midwifed by James Madison, coming back to Philadelphia, president of the American Philosophical Society, which he loved, vice president of the United States. He made the best of it, and he winds up writing the Manual of Parliamentary Procedure, which is still the Bible of the United States Senate with a few adjustments. What a story. So listen now to this podcast edition of Jefferson 101, this time Jefferson, Vice President of the United States.
Good day, citizens, and welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson, and sometimes your weekly conversation with Mr. Clay Jenkinson, who is seated across from me now. And Clay, you're back for another Jefferson 101.
It is time. We have placed Mr. Jefferson as Secretary of State, and we have retired him in the last days of the year 1793, and he has gone back to Monticello thinking that he would remain there for the rest of his life, that he was done with politics, that he was done as a public figure, and that his great desideratum, as he would have put it, was to be a quiet man of letters and gentleman farmer, and that he would never return to the scenes of so much strain as he had experienced as the first Secretary of State in the administration of his friend George Washington. So that's where we left him, that gone home, he's rebuilding Monticello, his daughter Maria gets married to her first cousin, Jack Epps. Jefferson starts a nail factory to supplement the income of his pretty badly managed plantation. And he believes, he's now in his early 50s, he believes that the remainder of his life, however long that might take, will be spent in and around Monticello.
That was a point that we discussed at length. There were many who believed that that was just... that he was not going to stay in retirement. He was taking a break, but that he would come back, and in fact, he did.
I don't think he intended to come back. I think he meant it. I think that he was tired. He'd really gotten roughed up in the cabinet of George Washington. He felt that he was out of sync with the counter-revolution that was going on in the country. He felt that he was outmaneuvered by a genius, Alexander Hamilton, and he felt deeply that George Washington preferred Hamilton, or at least Hamilton's ideas, to his own. And so Jefferson's view was, why would I want to be involved in a world where there's so much rancor and aggression and deliberate misunderstanding and character assassination and innuendo and political violence, at least rhetorical violence, when I could be home with my rutabagas and my grandchildren and my horses and my gardens and my library and baking bricks and rebuilding, doing creative things. Why would I want to be involved in politics? I'm not making any money from it. That's not why one serves in public life. It's not that I would make more money at home, but I can live at home as a quiet man of letters and gentleman farmer where my happiness is with my daughters and my garden, or I can go into the public arena where they treat me like some sort of Robespierre figure, and even Washington, who should know better, has some kind of a weird soft spot for Hamilton and allows Hamilton, who's not really one of us.
There's really more than a soft spot.
Yeah, that it's almost a bromance. I mean, from Jefferson's mind, it's like, what? Why could Washington, who should know better, favor this Hamilton?
The jilted lover.
There is some. It's more like, it's not so much that. It's in a way, and this is kind of a cliche of this period, but that Jefferson and Hamilton are the two surrogate sons of George Washington, who had no biological children, and that they're both competing for the great man's love and affection and respect. But the fact is, and it really drove Jefferson nuts to have to admit this, the president of the United States, the greatest American, George Washington, actually preferred Hamilton. If he had to spend an evening with one of the two of them, he would prefer Hamilton. If he had to listen to one of them in a question in which his mind was not made up, he basically thought Hamilton had the better argument and that Hamilton understood the need for a national government much better than Jefferson. I think Washington regarded Jefferson as a bit too much of a visionary utopian. That of course, it was an attractive vision that Jefferson was articulating, but how realistic was it? And how do we get there? Meanwhile, Hamilton is talking about practical things. How do you handle the national debt? How do you create a viable fiscal system? Do we need a national bank? What's the way to interpret the Constitution so that it's a flexible instrument? How can we honor the fact that most of our trade is with Britain, whether we like Britain or not? Our prosperity is because we work with Britain. Yes, France has been our friend, and yes, we owe loyalty to France for the success of the war, but it's really about what works economically, and we could just hold our nose and trade with Britain. Because whatever you think about this, it works. It's prospering. It's creating – it's giving America a chance to grow as a young nation. And so they both looked on Jefferson as sort of this well-meaning, utopian idealist who probably should not be trusted too much at the levers of power. And that just drove Jefferson nuts that – I mean, he didn't care whether Hamilton liked him or not. He loved to.
Oh, I bet he did.
But he wanted to get along with everyone, and of course he could. He and Hamilton at a dinner party. May I help you to some more wine, sir? And do the gravy? Do you think it's adequate? And you know, tell me more about your law practice and so on. But behind the scenes, they loathed each other. But that didn't particularly upset Jefferson because Jefferson thought he was right and Hamilton was wrong. But what really hurt and offended Jefferson was that the great man clearly preferred Hamilton to himself.
I think Jefferson brought part of that on himself. But the purpose of this program, if I might, would be in our long-running Jefferson 101 series, we're taking Mr. Jefferson back to Washington. Now, to break that, before we go, you and I had a discussion prior to today's show's taping, and I told you that I had gone back and reread Isaac Jefferson Granger's interview.
A slave at Monticello.
Right.
Luckily, we have this precious document of some sort of a transcript or paraphrase of an interview with Isaac.
You talked earlier about, you know, Jefferson's love of being at Monticello. There's a part in that interview, I should have it in front of me here, but he talks about Jefferson, how he would get up in the morning and that they wouldn't see him before 8 when he would have breakfast. If it was very warm, he wouldn't ride. He would go straight up to his office and work there until dinner time, which I'm not sure when
that would have been. Mid-afternoon, 2, 3 p.m.
And how you would go into his office.
I mean his private suite, his library / bedroom / dressing room /
right.
Office.
And this wonderful description of how he may have up to 20 books.
Strewn around the floor.
And you would ask him something and he would go immediately to the book that had that fact in it and find it. And Isaac's amazement at how this man's mind worked. And I, you know me, I'm just a sucker for that first person stuff. I loved it.
Well, you know, David, I'm sure all of our listeners will remember when they were children and they'd be at the dinner table and some question would come up and the head of household would say, well, let's look that up. And you run for the encyclopedia and you come back and you're paging through. It's the World Book and you find, oh, there's the essay on the St. Lawrence Seaway, or there's the encyclopedia entry on Paris or whatever it is, and you look things up. Well, I love books. I can't say that I love books more than Jefferson, who said, I cannot live without books, but it's right up there.
Oh, I think that would apply to you.
For me, David, the greatest joy that I get, I have a library of, I suppose, 19,000 volumes now. If someone says, well, what about the Reformation figure Melanchthon? I can go straight down to my library and within minutes, 1, 2, 4 volumes that pertain to this and pull it out.
And duplicates.
And it's so lovely to be able to do this. And so for Isaac's view of this, that you go into Jefferson's, it's called his Sanctum Sanctorum. It's his private suite of rooms that most people never get access to. It's where Jefferson goes to be Jefferson. It's not the public Jefferson. It's the scholar private Jefferson. And that's where his bedroom is. That's where his library is, and he's very particular about his library. I'm not, you know, but Jefferson's, every book is in its place. You don't want to borrow a book because I don't know if I'm ever going to get it back, and he'd had that bad experience once with Patrick Henry. So Jefferson is a man of, he loves his order. He loves to control all of the controllable circumstances of life, and he is happiest, I believe, as an intellectual, as a man of letters, it was known then, but as an intellectual. And so Isaac says, you go in there, you know, you're sent in to ask him something or to bring him some food or whatever it is. And there he is with 10, 20 books strewn around the carpet because he's been looking stuff up. Well, today, of course, you use your smartphone or Alexa and say, Alexa, what's the population of Ukraine? But for Jefferson, this was an odyssey involving pulling books off shelves and opening them up to a certain place, and then making notes based upon that.
Yeah, I seem to remember something about him saying that Mr. Jefferson did not suffer interruptions well.
No,
leave me alone.
Jefferson liked to protect his time. Jefferson said that he worked on the European model. So let's say that the Madisons and the Monroes are over as guests for the weekend. They're on their own until midday. From the morning until midday, Jefferson is ensconced alone in his suite of offices, his cabinet, his sanctum sanctorum. You're on your own. You can ride horses. You can read. You can take tea. You can walk, whatever you want to do. But Jefferson's not available until at least noon and maybe mid-afternoon. Then everyone gathers for dinner, for the main meal of the day. And now Jefferson is the most gracious and convivial of hosts, asking you questions, engaging in conversation, not political usually, but about ideas. Then after this prolonged meal, which takes an hour, maybe 2 hours, maybe 2.5 hours, people split up again, and Jefferson goes horse riding, or Jefferson goes to do something in the garden, other people do something else, have a postprandial walk. There will be another gathering for tea in the early evening at 6 or 7. And then after that, Jefferson disappears again, David, into his room, and you don't see him until noon or 1 p.m. the next day. That's the European model of hospitality. Jefferson was rigid about it because he knew he needed to protect his correspondence time, he wanted to protect his reading time, he wanted to protect his garden time, and he wanted mostly to be alone. He liked other people, but he mostly wanted to be alone with his books and his notebooks and his pens and his polygraph and his telescope and his sextant and all the other things that he found great delight in owning and playing with.
So here we are, Jefferson 101, getting Mr. Jefferson back to Washington. You mentioned Madison. As you can hear from the music, it's time for us to take a short break. When we come back, though, I would like your take on how much Mr. Madison influenced Jefferson's return to Washington. Would that be all right?
Fair enough.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. While we're taking our break between segments, Clay, I would like to take a moment to update people on our traveling Thomas Jefferson. You're going to be in Norfolk soon.
I'm heading for the road. You know, I began my work as Thomas Jefferson as a stand-up performer. We do the Jefferson Hour here on the Great Plains, but I'm coming back to Newport News, to the Ferguson Center for the Arts, Wednesday, April 19th, from 7:30 to 9 p.m.
And you've been to Norfolk many times.
Many, many times. Newport News, Norfolk, Suffolk, Virginia Beach. It's one of the best places in the country for my work. I have friends there. I can't wait to come back. It is a place that gives me greater joy and insight into what I'm doing than any other location.
And you can find more information about this at jeffersonhour.com.
Ferguson Center for the Arts, Wednesday, April 19th. We'll see you there, and we will talk revolution.
And now, it's back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation about President Thomas Jefferson this week. We're doing our Jefferson 101 series, and it's Jefferson's return to Washington after his early first retirement at Monticello. When we took our break, I had mentioned that I wanted to learn more about the effect Mr. Madison had on Jefferson. Jefferson, we're trying to get him back to Washington, right?
I'm sort of wanting him to linger in his idyllic world at Monticello, but he can't. So Adams and Hamilton and the rest would say, Jefferson's just biding his time. He wants to come back. He wants power. This is a political strategy of retirement. He doesn't mean it. He's just waiting for the moment when he can get back to the center and take power because of his own ambition.
Well, there was no power for the Republicans, the Democratic Republicans at that point. The Federalists had control of everything. And you know, without knowing specifically, my impression is that Madison almost looked at Jefferson as kind of a savior of the Democratic Republican ideals.
He did.
I think it's also really interesting that Madison was a Federalist, but he turned.
Well, Madison was the author of the Bill of Rights and essentially the founder of the Constitution of the United States. He was the central figure in this, and he wanted a stronger central government. He had seen the weakness of the Articles of Confederation. He had done an immense amount of reading, thanks partly to Jefferson, and he had decided that this thing's not going to work unless we have quite a bit stronger central authority than we've had. And so he creates the Madison Plan, which becomes the Virginia Plan at the Constitutional Convention. That plan did not get enacted in its entirety, but effectively he helped us to get a much stronger central government, and this was done behind closed doors. Once the Constitution process was over in mid-September of 1787, Madison knew, all right, somehow, it's like a secular miracle, we have forged together a much better Constitution here in Philadelphia. Now I have to run it by Jefferson, because there had been a secrecy rule, so Jefferson was not aware, nor was anyone else, of what really was going on in Independence Hall in Philadelphia. Madison felt that Madison was right, stronger government, but he also knew that Jefferson was going to be tugging the other way and probably critical of the new Constitution. So then he writes to Jefferson and tries to ease Jefferson into acceptance of the new Constitution of the United States. So at this point, you could say Madison is a sort of Federalist, not a party Federalist, but a central government Federalists.
Well, the parties were quite undefined at that point, too.
Not yet there. So Jefferson begins to...
But he did come over to Jefferson's side. That's fair to say.
That's the point. Once he and Jefferson start corresponding, Jefferson works the Jefferson magic on his old friend, and Madison slowly starts to drift, or to use the metaphor of a pendulum, Madison's pendulum begins to swing back towards Jefferson, and eventually they become almost indistinguishable in their politics. But Madison is always a little less utopian than Jefferson, always more pragmatic. This drives Hamilton nuts because Hamilton and Madison were close, and they agreed on a lot of things. They were the two principal authors of the Federalist Papers. Suddenly, Jefferson comes back from Europe, and Hamilton watches his friend Madison drifting to the left towards Jefferson. He doesn't like it. He's bewildered. What happened to the Madison I knew? And what's the – he thinks, what is the power of this Jefferson? Why is Jefferson so charismatic that he can make a pretty sober political thinker Madison drift towards idealism? So everyone's concerned. Even George Washington doesn't quite like what's happening to Madison because at first Washington uses Madison as his sounding board. Madison writes the first draft of what will become Washington's farewell address. Washington has Madison take on a lot of ghostwriting tasks for him, and he watches with some bewilderment and chagrin as Jefferson sort of seduces Madison back to Jefferson's point of view once he returns.
I want to challenge a word that you used.
Seduce?
No, left. You said drifted towards the left.
I don't know what other term to use.
Just to make a rule, it was those who felt that we really needed a strong central government.
They're the Federalists.
And those who felt that the states should be supreme.
They're the Anti-Federalists. So Jefferson is not quite an Anti-Federalist. He says explicitly, I'm not an Anti-Federalist. I am a moderate Federalist. But I want to err on the side of state authority, and I want to protect us from erecting too strong a central government. That, he says, would be like bringing in a fox to police the henhouse.
And nowadays, the left would probably be associated more with a strong central government.
Right. It's all changed. The terms don't really work. But you're right. It's Federalist, Anti-Federalist. Jefferson is essentially a kind of enamored of Anti-Federalism, but he doesn't want to take it too far. He's more suspicious of central authority than Madison ever would be. And Jefferson is sort of the founding father of the greatest of the founding fathers who advocated states' rights, that North Carolina is more competent than Washington, D.C. to settle issues involving North Carolina.
Could you talk a little bit about how popular Jefferson was during this time? I mean, it's almost like people expected him to become president. He was, as you just said, one of the greatest of the founding fathers.
In many respects, and he was also the author of the celebrated Declaration of Independence. And, you know, it's hard to think of a good analogy in our own time, David, but think of someone that has sort of a little of Stephen Hawking's and a little of Bill Gates and, that kind of – he's a genius. We're in the presence of a very special human being here, a man of exquisite sensibilities, who knows his wine, who knows art, who writes the best sentence, the best paragraph in American life. He's the most gifted prose stylist. Whatever he does with genius, his gardens, his architecture. Everyone gets it that Jefferson is a very special breed of man. He's our Da Vinci is the way I put it. But he's something extraordinarily unusual. We don't really have that at the moment, but you get the point.
Absolutely.
Everyone sees this in Jefferson.
Yes.
But they also see he's maybe a little too deeply into that to be a reliable political figure because we do, after all, live in the real world. And Jefferson is sort of this magnificent artist, creator, philosopher, prince of Monticello. And you sort of want him around because he's your greatest American in some regards, but he also sort of believes some of that stuff that comes out of his mouth about the people and democracy. And
you have talked and taught me early on that when the Declaration of Independence was written, people didn't associate its authorship with Jefferson.
Not until almost 1800.
Right. So this is the period where they began to find out who he was. And you've also talked about how popular he was. So is my guess that there was an expectation that he was going to become president? Is that far-fetched?
He would have automatically been president if it weren't for his what was regarded as extreme radical philosophy. In other words, if Jefferson had been just a kind of run-of-the-mill, like John Adams, we want a republic, but you know, let's not get ahead of human nature here. Let's do this with some proper grounding in the practical world. If Jefferson had been that figure, he would have swept into the White House right after John Adams, and no one would have raised an eyebrow. But Jefferson had failed as the governor of Virginia. Even Jefferson knew he had failed as the governor of Virginia. Jefferson had slaves. There were already rumors about a Congo harem at Monticello. Jefferson was so continental, so pro-French, and so anti-British, I mean, completely, almost, well, Hamilton said he has a womanish dislike of Britain. I mean, there was kind of an emotional commitment Jefferson had to dislike Great Britain. And Hamilton's view was, come on, they're just a trading partner.
Not when you had suffered the British coming to your house and
right.
and all that he suffered.
But all these people who will admit he is the bona fide philosopher genius amongst us.
And it was only the third election, so the country was still working all this out, right?
But they all admire Jefferson, but they're not sure that he really is sufficiently planted in the earth to run a country. And I mean, Hamilton says, and we laugh at it, but it's sort of true. He says he would be a great headmaster of an academy. You know, we get it. We love him. We admire him.
Hamilton said that.
Yeah, but you know, really, do you want to put him in with the levers of power? Because, I mean, someone like Hamilton and Adams disagreed on almost everything, but they would agree on this, that Jefferson's view of human nature is not an accurate read. Humans are not always good. They're not always their best selves. They don't rise above their petty self-interests.
But you've always said that it's what we aim for.
Right. I'm Jefferson's advocate. Thank goodness Jefferson became the president of the United States. But it wasn't easy, and it would have been much easier if he had just been a centrist and a pragmatist. But Madison's goal when Jefferson gets back from France is to bring him back into the arena. And Jefferson serves as the Secretary of State for Washington, but it's a terrible experience for him.
As we talked about in the last 101 series, and it was a letter that you pointed me to that I wasn't aware of, and you called it one of the most revealing letters he ever wrote about his, I can't remember the word, but he wrote to his daughter, and he'd kind of come to the conclusion that all this time alone at Monticello
he'd become antisocial, misanthropic,
right.
That be careful about withdrawing from the world. I did for a couple of years after 1793. And I soon noticed that it had a negative effect on me, and it made me kind of a gloomy.
So he was ready to get back in the arena.
He was ready for something. I'll tell you what brought him back, though. So first of all, he left the Washington administration somewhat bitter and thought, I am going home. I've basically been defeated. Washington basically is a Hamiltonian. But he felt, honestly, that the future of the country was in jeopardy because the wrong people were in power and they were moving the country in the wrong direction. He thought, I'll just wash my hands of it. I'll grow turnips and write letters. But in some sense, he knew he wasn't going to be okay with that. Then the Jay Treaty occurred in 1794. John Jay goes to England to try to settle issues that still linger from the Revolutionary War settlement, and he comes back with a treaty which is basically extremely favorable to Britain's interests, and it doesn't do much for the United States. And there was widespread outrage at the treaty. And Jefferson then thinks, these guys are dangerous because he calls them Anglo-men. They're basically subservient. They're monarchists. They're aristocrats. They're money men. They're speculators. They're the rich, what we would call the 1%. And they're basically re-enslaving us to Great Britain merely for economic advantage, not because it's good for the country in other ways, but because it profits. And who profits? Not the average American. The people who profit are the 1%, are the the privileged. And so when he sees the Jay Treaty, Jefferson thinks, no, we're going to have to fight for this country. This is not just going to work out benignly. We are going to have to fight for the soul of the country. So the Jay Treaty is what propels him to get engaged again. He starts subscribing to newspapers again and corresponding and asking pointed questions about policy. You can see he's on his way back. Well, then there's this kind of tacit agreement that he and Madison come to. Madison basically says, without saying it, I'm going to make you the president of the United States in the election of 1796. Jefferson's view is, if you tell me that, I won't do it. So if you're going to do that, I don't want to hear about it. I want to have deniability. I want to be able to pretend it, even to myself, that I was just minding my own business at Monticello. If my friends somehow bring me in, I suppose I'll reluctantly have to accept it. So they have this agreement. Madison won't talk about it. Jefferson won't talk about it. He doesn't really want it, but he knows if it happens, he'll do it. Well, he loses.
To people in our time, that sounds just not right. But to people in Jefferson's time, that was not an unusual pattern. So you've taught me that about the humility.
Jefferson meant it, too. I mean, his view really was, look, I know my happiness is here at Monticello. There's no happiness in Philadelphia. I know my happiness is here, but the country is drifting in a really wrong-headed direction because the people at the helm are the wrong people and they are been infected by the wrong ideas. And he wouldn't admit this even to himself, but and I'm the only person who can stop this.
I guess my point is that it's something that's lost in politics now, and that is extreme humility from these candidates.
Jefferson had it, but they all were, they all had to kind of talk this way. This, you know, idea of Cincinnatus, the reluctant farmer who becomes the leader temporarily.
It's a nice trait. I wish we still had it.
No, and it's a very good trait. And Jefferson, my point is, a lot of people don't think that Jefferson meant it. Adams thought that he was faking it and just waiting for his moment. Hamilton assumed that Jefferson was a Machiavel. A lot of people thought, come on.
That's an argument we're not going to settle.
But I believe that Jefferson meant it. I believe that he wasn't lying even to himself. But I think he also thought, this experiment in liberty, this is the chance ever that humans are going to get to prove that they're up to the business of self-government. However much I prefer to be in my garden or reading my Thucydides, I have no choice if the moment comes but to try to write this republic and put it back on its revolutionary and idealistic path. And I, Jefferson, am better able to understand it and do it than anyone else. And so if the moment came, I would take it. Well, then the election occurs.
So I have to say, what you're saying is that he felt a responsibility. Can you talk about that?
He felt a responsibility because, see, we take it for granted. We say, you know, America's the greatest success in the history of countries and we have the longest lasting and best constitution of any nation and more happiness and prosperity than any people who ever lived. And we take all these things for granted. But that wasn't to be taken for granted. These people were engaged. It's not that different from, except in ideology, from the communist experiment in the Soviet Union. They're trying a very interesting, strange, dangerous, perplexing thing here with a republic. A republic is something you talk about in a philosophy class or in a political theory class, but no one really does it. Nations are nations, and they engage in naked self-interest and war and so on. Here's this new country that's lifted itself up with all of this high-minded rhetoric and philosophy about the rights of man and quotations from John Locke and so on. Jefferson believed that this was humanity's not last chance, maybe last chance, but certainly best chance ever. New continent, unlimited resource base, 3,000 miles from Britain, idealistic war, a war that didn't devastate the countryside. This is the chance that humans are going to get if we blow this, if we screw this up. The setback will be interminable and maybe permanent to human aspirations to live in a decent, just, equal, and happy world. And so, if you're, David, if you're buying any of this, what I'm saying, then you have to say, well, of course, if someone like Madison will put you in power and you don't have to lift a finger, if you don't have to campaign, if you don't have to go to 300 cities, if you don't have to have news conferences, if you don't have to raise $300 million.
I am not thinking that.
If you just say at Monticello and write polite letters and take down the weather twice a day and somebody else makes you the president so that you can save the country, of course you say yes to that. But my point is that he would have been quite happy just to stay at Monticello, but he would have been happier if the country were moving in the right direction, and it wasn't to his mind, and so somebody had to fix it, and he was the fixer.
We need to take a short break. This week, we're back in our Jefferson 101 series, and we're getting Mr. Jefferson back to Washington.
Slowly.
But he'll get there.
Eventually.
When we return, I'd like to talk to you, Clay, about how that worked when he got to Washington, and obviously, the process of election was far different than it is today. Maybe you could explain that to us.
I'd be happy to, David.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Hello, everyone. This is Clay Jenkinson. I want to invite you to participate in this year's cultural tour on the Lewis and Clark Trail. It's our 12th time for me going up the Wendover Death March. This is the trip that never gets old. It's the highlight of my year. You'll see why when you come 3 days on the wild and scenic White Cliffs area of the Missouri River, east of Fort Benton, and then 4 days up on the Lolo Trail, the most pristine part of the entire Lewis and Clark route that starts at Monticello and ends at the shores of the Pacific Ocean. This is my favorite of all the cultural tours. You can sign up. It's July 18th through 27th. You can find out details at Odyssey Tours or jeffersonhour.org. We want to see you on the trail, and I hope that you will take a look at this and other cultural tours. Thanks. We'll see you there.
Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation about President Thomas Jefferson. This week we're doing our Jefferson 101 series, and we're up to Jefferson's return to Washington when he became vice president. At the end of the last segment, you talked about this experiment of the Republic. Don't you think that Jefferson, in his infinite wisdom, must have recognized that this was an experiment that really had no end?
Yes, but putting it in the right position early on is essential. So his view was, here we are just a few years in and we're already screwing it up. We're already giving it over to the rich and the privileged and the powerful and the banks and the speculators and the militarists. And his view was, come on, this is really? Because if this is the world's best chance ever to take all the philosophy that's been circulating around Europe for centuries now, the Enlightenment and Machiavelli and John Locke and Hume and Rousseau and Voltaire and all the philosophes, Condorcet, D'Holbach, all this, everybody's been writing about what it would be like. What would it be like to live in a just world where happiness and commonwealth interests are supreme? They're all writing about this. This is the theme of the Enlightenment. What if man could be happy? What if man could shrug off original sin and church hierarchies and feudalism and the social class systems and kingship and aristocracy and nonsense and so on? What if humans could ever liberate themselves from all of the weights that have been holding them down and crushing their spirit forever? What if this could happen? And then finally, voila, the United States happens. And Jefferson's view is, this is it, folks. This is it. We don't feel that way today. We feel, you know, if Bernie Sanders had been elected, we could make the country a little bit better. That's all we've got left. But in Jefferson's time, he believed this is the moment. And so he wanted very much for it to succeed, and he looked with such dismay at the government of the United States and the establishment of the United States taking it in what he thought was a disastrous direction, and the greatest American of all, George Washington, was complicit in what he regarded as a conspiracy to damage the idea of human happiness. So he makes this agreement with Madison. I'm never going to talk about it. I'm going to say I'm not doing it. If it happens, I'll take it. Well, then the election does happen. and Adams wins, barely.
In our time, what is it, the first quarter of 2017, and there's already talk about the election of 2020. In Jefferson's time, that whole election process was relatively short, wasn't it?
A few months at most.
And it wasn't party-driven, so how did we even know who the candidates were?
It kind of burbled up, so the people thought, well, so Washington's obviously the first president, the only unanimously chosen president in American history. Then when Washington insists on retiring in 1796, the country sort of thinks, okay, now what? And so Adams says, hey, here I am. I'm the heir apparent. He actually uses those terms. I was the vice president. I'm one of the most significant founding fathers. I've been here for 8 years. It's my turn. And so the country kind of thinks about that and says, okay, you know, yeah, all right.
Continuity.
But a lot of people like Jefferson are already disillusioned with what are now being known as the Federalists. And so we get the first little hints of opposition in the election of 1796. But the country goes ahead and affirms the succession so that Adams becomes the second president of the United States. So the system was informal and disorganized, but to answer your question, you know, we now have a 3-year or at least 2-year campaign period for the presidency. In Jefferson's time, you know, a few weeks or months. Adams wins, but the surprise is that Jefferson takes second. That's because we hadn't yet differentiated ticketing between vice president and president. So when Jefferson – a bunch of wonderful stuff happens now, David. Number one, when Jefferson learns that he's going to be vice president, he says, oh, thank goodness. So he says this. This is a great letter. If I am to act, however – if I'm going back into the public world, a more tranquil and unoffending station could not have been found for me than the vice presidency. It will give me philosophical evenings in the winter and rural days in the summer. The second office of our government is honorable and easy. The first is but a splendid misery. So first of all, he makes this statement. He was elected to be the president of the American Philosophical Society on the same time. So he's going to Philadelphia, where the intellectual capital of America, one of the intellectual capitals of the world, and he's saying, look, in a sense, he's saying someone will pay my bills. I'll get to live in Philadelphia. I'll get to be an active member of the American Philosophical Society. There are really no duties for the vice president. I won't have the burden of power. If I have to have a national office, this is the one I prefer. You know, does he really mean it? I think so. Then he says to Madison, maybe I don't even have to go for the inaugural. Maybe I can just kind of, maybe I can get a local judge here in Virginia to swear me in as vice president. And Madison's saying, oh, come on, you know, you got to do something here. You can't just be an absentee vice president. So Jefferson says, all right, if I have to go to Philadelphia, maybe I can sneak in. Maybe I don't want any parades. I don't want any artillery. I don't want an escort. Maybe I just sneak in by back roads into Philadelphia and quietly take the oath and then come back to Virginia. And again, Madison's saying, look, you get it, don't you, that you're now the vice president of the United States. There are certain things you're going to have to put up with. And one of them is you can't sneak into Washington, D.C. You can't be to take the oath of office in some courthouse in Richmond. You have to go step up. So Jefferson goes. He no sooner gets into this office, David, and people, the Federalists are kind of, their view is, thank God John Adams is vigorous, because if he died, that philosopher who spent too much time in France might become president. And then when Jefferson just gets settled in Philadelphia and he takes great pride in being installed as the president, not of the country, but of the American Philosophical Society. As soon as that happens, the Matzai letter is leaked. You know the Matzai letter? So in the Matzai letter, Jefferson writes to his old friend Philip Matzai and says, you would be surprised to see how men who were Samsons in the field and Solomons in the temple have had their hair shorn by the harlot England. Matzai gets the letter. He publishes it in Italian without getting Jefferson's permission. A French newspaper translates it from Italian into French. It gets more and more garbled as it goes. Then Noah Webster back in America translates it into English, garbled. So it's no longer really what Jefferson wrote. But it's bad because he has said men who were Samsons in the field, George Washington, and Solomons in the temple, the untouchable George Washington, have, quote, had their hair shorn by the harlot England. He also said that we have changed some of the forms of our government, but the translation said form. And so his enemies said, look, he's saying that we're now a British-style constitution when we're not. So the letter leaks. Washington is hurt. The Federalists, of course, in high dudgeon and outrage. It's the culture of outrage even then. Jefferson now makes the most important decision of his life. First of all, he writes to Washington and says, you realize, sir, that I didn't mean this, and even if I meant it, it was just that moment, and even if it was just that moment, it was leaked on, you know, blah, blah, blah. That's typical Jefferson. But then he decides, he and Madison decide, you know what? Jefferson says, I'm gonna own this letter. I'm not going to turn away any longer. This is what I think. I think the country is headed in the wrong direction. I'm not going to just defend myself and try to slip away the way I usually do. I'm going to step up, and I'm going to be the standard bearer of the opposition to what's going wrong with this country. I'm going to accept now the responsibility of being the figure who's going to stand for the presidency in 1800. I may win or lose, but if I win, I'm going to try to correct what went wrong. So the Matsai letter is the moment when Jefferson decides he's not going to play this rural, pastoral, Virgilian, I just want to be left alone game any longer. He is now going to step up and do what he can to win the election of 1800 and to fix America before the experiment is lost forever. So that letter, he was highly embarrassed because, of course, you know, do you really want George Washington reading that letter? Jefferson finally just says, I'm going to have to accept the fact that I am actually a principled opponent of where things are headed. I'm an opponent of what Washington did.
Must have been sort of a relief for him.
It was. It's like, no, because Jefferson's a character, as I always say, out of a Jane Austen novel. He never wants to offend. He doesn't want conflict. He loves harmony. He said, take things always by their smooth handle. He always tries to pretend that there's no issue when there is an issue. He always writes this letter saying, my dear sir, this was a leaked letter. You mustn't take it seriously. It garbled it, by the way, and I don't really feel that. Now, for the first time, David, Jefferson says, you know what? I am going to accept the fact that I am creating an opposition to the existing establishment of this country, and I am going to do what it takes to gain power, not for myself, but for the cause of human liberty. And if that means that some people don't want to be my friends any longer or have lost respect for me because I'm willing even to challenge the untouchable Washington, I'm doing it.
Here we have him sort of neutering himself as vice president. What did he do as vice president?
Well, that's the great thing. So first of all, he's doing what Jefferson does, playing the violin, making small inventions, corresponding with scientists and savants. He presents a paper on the megalonyx, which he, this great claw, this lion-like creature, to the American Philosophical Society. But he's in the Senate. His one constitutional duty is to preside over the Senate. Back then, they did. You know, today, a vice president only goes to the Senate when there's a tie or when there's a ceremonial occasion. But back in Jefferson's time, he actually did preside over the Senate.
The rules of the Senate were kind of a mess.
And they're all crazy, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So Jefferson's sitting there like twiddling his thumbs thinking, oh, this is dull. Oh, this is stupid. There they go again. This is what I could be doing so much more if I were just at Monticello, making little lists of things he's going to do back home, how many bricks he wants baked this year, and so on and so forth. What if we had a cabinet that looked like this? You know, it had a wine dumbwaiter. I could do that. So he's just sitting there twiddling his thumbs. And then he thinks, you know what? I could write a manual that would put this thing into kind of orderliness. And so he writes to his old friend George Wythe, his great mentor, and says, what do you got? You got some ideas about parliamentary procedure? Send me anything you have. And Wythe writes back and sort of says, well, that's a great idea what you're doing. I don't really have anything to offer here, but I wish you well. Eventually, Wythe sort of steps up a little bit. But Jefferson then gathers everything. Philadelphia is the second city of the British Empire. And he sits down, puts all these books, as Isaac says, all over his table. He's, by the way, remodeling his vice presidential home. He always remodels whatever home he's in at great expense, which he doesn't have the money to pay for. And he spreads out these books and he thinks, all right, so how do you break a tie? How many votes for this? What kind of point of order? How should you address a fellow senator when you agree or when you disagree? How do we adjourn? How do we recess? And so he goes through and he writes this manual, which is published just at the moment he leaves the vice presidency. his Manual of Senate Procedure. And, David, that manual is still used today with a few adjustments that Jefferson wrote because he was A, bored, and B, he loved order. And so he just sat there as the sitting vice president and said, you know what I'll do? I'll write a manual of how to do this right.
Wonderful conversation this week. I thank you for it, sir. I always learn so much from these Jefferson 101 series. But now, for some perspective on the vice presidency, it's time for this week's Jefferson Watch.
Thomas Jefferson did not know he was going to become the vice president of the United States. At that early moment in the American constitutional experiment, the person who got the most number of electoral votes became president. The person who came in second became the vice president, irrespective of party affiliation or his relationship with the president. Adams won the election of 1796 with 71 votes. Jefferson was runner-up with 68. The 55 men who crafted the United States Constitution in the summer of 1787 were not really sure what a vice president should do. It was not until near the end of their deliberations that they decided he'd preside over the U.S. Senate, if only to give him something to do for his $5,000 a year salary. As Founding Father Roger Sherman said, if the vice president were not to be president of the Senate, he would be without employment. Disenchantment with the vice presidency began early. The nation's very first vice president, John Adams, called the office, quote, the most insignificant office that ever the invention of man contrived or his imagination conceived. I am vice president, Adams lamented. In this I am nothing, but I may be everything. 100 years later, Theodore Roosevelt called the vice presidency a cul-de-sac, and suggested that the office ought to be abolished. The 32nd vice president, John Nance Garner, who served under FDR, is often quoted as saying the vice presidency is, quote, not worth a bucket of warm spit, when in fact the term that he used was a bucket of warm, well, I'll say urine. Nance, a Texan, said accepting the vice presidency was, quote, the worst damn fool mistake I ever made. You get the point. Jefferson approached the vice presidency as he did everything else in his life. He mastered the work, reveled in whatever time it afforded him for his rich intellectual life, and looked around for ways to make the job more efficient and more useful. Today's vice presidents rarely actually preside over the Senate. They show up only on photo op days, ceremonial occasions, or when there is a potential tie in the Senate that they intend to break in favor of the administration they serve. Jefferson took his job seriously, as usual, and presided over the Senate with his usual courtesy, orderliness, and fairness. Jefferson was one of the most orderly men who ever lived. He was not a control freak in the modern sense of the term, but he was always happiest when he controlled as many of the circumstances of his life as possible. He was not so much bored as bewildered by the haphazard procedures of the early Senate, so he decided to write a manual of Senate procedure. He wrote his old law mentor, George Wythe, several times to ask for recommendations of what he should read to prepare, but Wythe was unable to offer much help. Nevertheless, the result was Jefferson's masterful Manual of Parliamentary Practice, published on February 27, 1801. With a few adjustments, Jefferson's manual is still being used by the United States Senate. Jefferson was not one of the most important vice presidents in American history. That honor probably belongs to Al Gore or perhaps Dick Cheney, depending upon your definition of important. For one brief shining moment early on, President Adams approached Jefferson to see if they might in some way serve as co-presidents. Jefferson loved his old friend more than he loved power. That was always his style. But he loved his Republican vision more than he loved Adams. Meanwhile, Adams was soon warned by the usual vicious partisans, in this case Federalists, that he must have nothing to do with the dangerous radical and infidel Jefferson. So we lost a great opportunity there, back when that tradition might have taken root and made America a better republic. The vice presidency turned out to be just what Jefferson had predicted, philosophical evenings in winter and summers at his beloved Monticello. You see, Jefferson won two elections in 1796. He became the second vice president, but that year he was also elected president of the American Philosophical Society. That, by far, was the greater honor for a man who despised politics and preferred to circulate among the savants, literati, philosophes, amateur scientists, reformers, antiquarians, and men of letters of the world. Power meant nothing to Jefferson, except insofar as he could use it, as the Enlightenment put it, to ameliorate the condition of mankind. On any list of Jefferson's greatest hits, being vice president doesn't even register. It's a bucket of, well, urine. Only for those who thirst for power. I'm Clay Jenkinson. We'll see you next week for another exciting edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is brought to you each week by Dakota Sky Education. The program is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Radio. President Thomas Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay S. Jenkinson. To obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 888-828-2853. Again, that number is 888-828-2853. This program is also available online at jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you'd like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the program, please visit the website at jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening. Please tune in again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.